This work really was made possible by Katie and Maurice. I met Katie and Maurice 30 years ago when they visited Ken Hagen, who was also Katie's graduate advisor. And as we will see over the next few slides, very specifically, Charlie Henry and Peter Dwelly were led into the work that came to this collaboration by specific early papers by Katie and Maurice. For Charlie Henry, it was the reproductive isolation studies, important seminal works published, as you see, in the late 70s. This is what led Charlie into, ultimately, the behavioral studies, the courtship behavioral studies, that were what drew the group of the four of us for this project together. Steve Brooks, straight traditional taxonomist by and large, but with Katie's important diverse works in chrysopid taxonomy, Steve has been influenced by many of them. Peter Dwelly literally came to the United States to work with Ken Hagen because of your works on diapause. And with that, not only did he also have the pleasure of meeting you in the late 70s, he and I shared a lab and have become lifelong friends and, again, contributed to what led to the project I'm going to explain in a few seconds. For me, for those of you who know me, I suffer from a lack of focus. I do a lot of different things, but probably more than any other one individual that I've stalked scientifically, it would be Katie with her diversity of work on lacewing biology, behavior, and systematics. But I do feel compelled to point out that they did have one questionable move in their career they co-authored with this guy, but that was really a great pleasure to have, by coincidence, lacewings that Peter Dwelly had brought back from Hawaii that I did some developmental studies on and later converged with the Tauber's work on the endemic Hawaiian lacewings in the genus Anomalocrysa. Now, just because there aren't going to be very many pictures of bugs in here, take my word for it, it's Pluribunda. It's one of the cryptic species, so we don't need to dwell there. They all look the same. That's the reality. As Katie said in her talk yesterday, taxonomy in chrysopids was long based on venation and coloration. This didn't work so well. As you see down in the bottom, siblings and even individuals can key to different species or genera depending on which set of wings you look at. And there's a famous case of Navas describing a new genus of Barothid based on an anomalous left wing that had an additional radial sector. If he'd looked at the right wing, we'd have one less synonymy from that individual. And yes, and it's quite a jolt, but it seems, you know, I mean, this has been going on for centuries. People really should have known it, but it was not until the 60s when Bogetter and the Taubers began to make serious strides to helping us clarify chrysopid systematics. As you see, the approaches were different, starting with primarily an anatomical emphasis, looking at male genitalia, allowed Bogetter to make major strides, but he did also begin to look at biological characters, and it was including the biological character of diapause that allowed him to recognize Chrysoperla as a distinct subgenus. Katie and Maurice, their works are so numerous and so diverse that I'm not even going to try to recap them, but there you can see a list of topics: physiology, nutrition, diapause, Boltonism, larval anatomy, reproductive isolation studies. Working with Chrysopa and Chrysoperla have been foundational to the effort that Charlie Henry, Peter Dwelly, Steve Brooks, and I began. I'm stealing a little bit from Katie here. For me specifically, it was the Chrysoperla larval taxonomy work that led me to be able to contribute to the project I'm going to report on. These, however, are not Katie's far more elegant pictures. These are from the European project, and they are my artwork. But I put them up there because most of this talk is going to be on the European species, and you can see the kinds of differences that occur. The longitudinal stripe varies in width. whether there's a dark spot in it. The lateral arm here varies in form from very slender to broad, and then over here you can see that in some species there are medial spots on the head, and that is the most convenient means of trying to differentiate the species. The next dominant step in overall chrysopid taxonomy, Brooks and Bernard, 1990, revised the genera of the family based on male genitalia, and this really stabilized to a great extent the taxonomy in the family. Further revisions, as Katie talked about yesterday, are occurring, but they are now relatively minor. This set an important framework. Now, shifting to Chrysoperla, you'll notice we're not on a linear timeline. I'm trying to aggregate things into what I hope is a convenient and coherent package for you. In 1998, a meeting that I was unable to attend, the neuropterist concluded that figuring out the true taxonomy, as best we can, of Chrysoperla was important. It was regarded as the key taxonomic issue, quote, holy grail of neuropterology, as somebody described it. In addition to addressing the basic taxonomic questions, we had the issue of understanding very diverse and sometimes directly conflicting reports on habitat preference and other aspects of biology, including diapause responses, and ultimately related to biological control. Chrysoperla carnea, in quotes, was being reared by many laboratories and being released sometimes at great distances from where they were collected, so that there was a serious risk of introducing species, if it was a multiple species complex, serious risk of introducing species into new areas. And with the habitat preferences, there was certainly a possibility of improving the quality of biological control programs. The French group, starting in the early 90s, began to realize that there was an apparent complex of species of Chrysoperla in Europe going under the name of Chrysoperla carnea. Steve Brooks, a few years later, revised Chrysoperla, again anatomically based, using the genitalia primarily, identified, recognized 36 species in four species groups. The four species groups are listed here, and the one we are interested in, of course, is the carnea group. The results of Steve's work at the species level were very good in the first three species groups, but genitalia did prove inadequate in the Chrysoperla carnea group. And here is one of my favorite examples from a paper Charlie did, 36 illustrations of male genitalia of three species, just to prove you couldn't really tell them apart based on genitalia. And I still use this as my example to students that, yes, you actually can publish negative data. It just has to still be informative. So based on Steve's work, what happened was that 85 species names were synonymized under Chrysoperla carnea, and it was now an extremely heterogeneous species, anatomically, biologically, and ecologically variable and holarctic. Circling back now in time, in the late 70s, again motivated by the Tauber's work on speciation in Chrysoperla, Charlie Henry began to look at courtship behavior. Here you can see that the basic pattern is tremulation, where the male and female vibrate their abdomen up and down. Vibrations are carried by the substrate, detected by sensors in the tarsi of the hopefully conspecific individual, who will then, as you see, vibrate back in a duet. And only after that has occurred will mating normally occur. This is an old diagram of a system that Charlie has since upgraded, but to determine responses of individuals, he would record the song of an individual lacewing in this system, have them on a membrane, aka saran wrap. And in the old days, literally the arm of a record player to detect the vibrations through the needle, preamp recorded and then played back so that the membrane would vibrate, and he could then determine which song pattern the individual, an unknown individual, would respond to. The songs that Charlie recorded, he looked at seven features, as you can see listed here. The three that were most important were the volley duration and period, which are temporal, and the number of volleys per SRU, shortest repeated unit. As I said, the male and female duet. Some males will vibrate, have one burst of vibration, and then pause for the female to sing. Other males will sing several volleys of vibration before pausing for the female to respond, and it's that time when they pause for a female to respond that defines the SRU. What's really important and interesting is while these characters were species specific, as you would certainly expect in courtship behavior, they were also the characteristics that would not vary with substrate. These are examples of three of the North American species, just to show you the kind of differences that occurs in the pattern. And here is the demonstration of the duetting, the male singing, then the female singing, and obviously the female becoming more actively responsive with time. And after a period of the duetting is when they will mate. Normally, mating will occur only with an individual that sings back with essentially the same song that you produce, very minor variations between the sexes, and only when placed in a stressful situation with only a heterospecific individual will they normally have any hybridization. Based on this work, Charlie Henry realized that Carnia and Downs-eye in the eastern United States were distinct species, and this motivated him to ask Phil Adams and I, who were then located in California, to start sending Chrysoperla from the western U.S. And by virtue of good chance, Peter and I were again sharing a lab in Ken Hagen's facility. And when Peter went back to Europe, he supplied Carnia from Europe. And I, in my haste to prepare this talk among the chaos of the events induced by our economic trauma, I failed to note that the Taubers also have supplied specimens to Charlie Henry, so my apologies. Haste is not a good thing. Carnia in the western U.S., unlike in the east, included three species. The only species described from the area was Californica. And when we went to the Californica locality, the only species there was the now transcontinental, still Carnia in quotes. Based on the songs, Charlie and his collaborators described Chrysoperla adamsi and johnsoni based on songs. This was a first among Neuroptera. And that was in, as you see, 1993. Now, the main thrust of this story is the European work. Charlie had received numerous samples from Peter Dwelly indicating that there were five song species in Europe. And being Charlie, he, of course, had to name them. Peter, being Germanic, he used a nice simple number code. And in the end, Charlie found that there were these five distinct song types. Once those were recorded, none of them were found to be similar to the song of the North American Chrysoperla quote Carnia. Thus, Chrysoperla pluribunda was raised from synonymy, and this yielded a series of four species of Chrysoperla in the Carnia complex known from North America. Distributions, and in the case of johnsoni, almost exclusively on conifers, although there is a little population down in Arizona that lives on chaparral and is more yellow than green. So great variability in these species. The European project started out with what you would pretty much expect in terms of goals: determine the number of song species, see if the songs are reliable and stable across species range as they are in North America, then try to associate the song species with described taxa and with the specific goal of ascertaining the true Chrysoperla carnia, and then, of course, describe new species as needed. Procedures were, again, I think exactly what you'd expect. We suffered badly for three summers, forcing ourselves to collect across beautiful areas, relatively undisturbed areas in Europe. We got within 10 miles of the Riviera, but we were so focused we never went down there. We isolated them and carried individuals around in ice chests for up to a month. Charlie took them back to Connecticut, determined the song species, reared a few larvae from known adults, sent me larvae, I mass-produced larvae in adults. Just because I had so many on the table at one time, I isolated larvae not only by population but by generation, and every couple generations I sent a few pupae back to Charlie just to make sure there'd been no contamination. Pinned adults to send to Steve Brooks, boiled and preserved larvae. Charlie had the DNA, the molecular connection, so he froze or pickled some adults for later use for DNA analysis. With Peter Dwelly, we linked him to his detailed studies of biology and ecological traits of European Chrysoperla. We began trying to link song species to describe taxa, and then, as you will see, described some new taxa. The songs of the five European species are illustrated here, showing that they are quite distinct. Peter likes to vacation in the Middle East, so he had a number of samples of another one that we called Generator that is actually, he knew it from Eastern Asia. As we'll see later, it was then found to be conspecific with the African Zastrowe, the first trans-equatorial distribution of a Chrysoperla. This just shows the range of the species. You can see that they ranged over 2,000 to 3,000 kilometers east to west, and as you can see in a number of places, up to four species at a site, and the site in this case might be the area of a football field. And so no wonder they were having trouble using anatomy to define species in this group. Who knew what was variation within a species and variation between? And again, Generator, the pink is over here in the Middle East. What Charlie found was the songs are virtually uniform. What Steve and I found is that there was substantial variation anatomically within the song species. We're good linear thinkers, we're guys. We set out directly to figure out what the true Chrysoperla carnea was. At that point, we knew of two Chrysoperlas in England, which is the type locality. Well, London's the type locality for carnia, CC1 and CC4. But we knew that CC2 was just across the English Channel, so we looked at these. We found that we could rule out CC1 because it doesn't change color as an adult, and it has a brown stripe on the pleural membrane of the abdomen. Carnia was named because of its diapause coloration, which was, quote, meat-like, and the lectotype lacks the brown stripe on the abdominal membrane. So we were thinking that CC4 would likely be the true carnia, but we decided to wait a little bit because, again, CC2 was just across the channel. The lectotype is a female, so it lacks the best anatomical character, and it was sort of intermediate, a problem that you will see persists. So we decided we would wait a little while on this. We knocked off the two easy species. CC1 was determined to be Lucasina, based largely on their unique character among European Chrysoperla, the brown stripe on pleural membrane of abdominal segment 2. As you see there, included in the description of Lucasina and unique among European species. So we got one easy one in 96. The other one that proved to be fairly easy was the pine carnia, which had the same song as Chrysoperla mediterranea, but mediterranea was described because of this very large, distinct basal lobe on the tarsal claw, and yet when you put the song species together, what you find is a clinal variation in claw morphology. So the definition of mediterranea holtzel was expanded and I think stabilized the knowledge on taxonomic knowledge of that species. So at this point, we were really getting pretty determined to knock off Chrysoprolla carnea. We literally had a paper designating CC4 or motorboat as the true carnia, and it was literally ready to slide into an envelope and go into the mail. January 2000, when Colin Plant confounded the issue, finding CC2 literally on the grounds of Buckingham Palace. It turns out collecting on the grounds of Buckingham Palace requires some special permits. It took Steve a little bit of a time to get those. But anyway, motivated by this, Steve, to be more accurate than we, looked very carefully at the anatomical characters of CC2 and CC4, and he found a grand total of four where they do tend to differ, but there are intermediates very commonly in all of these. And again, the proportion of blonde seedy ventrally on the abdomen, color of the marking on the stipes, and as we've already seen in Mediterranean, there's variation in the basal dilation on the claw. Those were all a little scary. But then even here, the male genitalia didn't help. The best variation that he could find was the height of the lip relative to the chin. And again, that varied. And as noted before, the lectotype was intermediate. It was a female, was intermediate on the three characters that were present on a female lectotype, obviously lacking the male genitalia. So we were still left in confusion. Here, I take a moment just to remind you that if insects who'd been on a pin for a century or so were able to do anything useful like sing a courtship song and reproduce, Charlie easily could have told them apart by the courtship song, and in this case, I could have told them apart very easily by the larvae. CC2 never has a medial spot, and as you see here, the CC4 always has medial ornamentation on the head, at least in Western Europe. The only population that doesn't was from Central Russia. But that wasn't going to work, so we started to look at these things, and as you can see here, the carnia type series included individuals that were both CC2-like, CC4-like, and intermediate. Again, the lectotype was intermediate, so we were pretty well stymied anatomically. So we began to look at other things, abundance. CC2 is apparently rare in England. Still, to the best of my knowledge, known only from the grounds of Buckingham Palace. CC2 is arboreal and therefore less likely to have been collected. The gardeners at Buckingham Palace certainly could have accidentally introduced CC2 since the description of carnia. But we looked at other things. We looked for nomenclatural stability. The French group had applied carnia to CC2. That was tempting. Also, more work on, quote, carnia has been done in Southern Europe where CC2 tends to be more dominant, but CC2, again, is more abundant in woodlots and is arboreal. CC4 is more common in agricultural fields, and most of the work had been in agricultural settings. Ultimately, from my perspective, the thing that convinced me was that when CC2 diapauses, it goes into usually a tannish, a yellowish tan, sometimes more towards brown, whereas CC4 commonly turns a very distinctive reddish brown and is thus more flesh-like or meat-like, and thus I think more likely to be the true carnia. Based on the preponderance of the evidence, we did describe CC4 as carnia, or designate CC4 as carnia. That left us with two other species, CC2 and CC3, that we had to deal with. By virtue of being unable to associate CC2 with any described species and the fact that it tended to be blonder than CC4, it was described as Chrysoprolla pallida in 2002. And that left us with one last challenge, CC3. Again, couldn't confidently associate it with any of those previous 85 names. We had the issue that the French group had applied Chrysoprolla coltophi, but coltophi was described from China, and we did not know CC3 from east of Iran at the time. Based on that and its extreme wide geographic range. We named it Agilis. And then you'll note down here in 2007, we had a real surprise. A former student of mine reported seeing pink lacewings near Anchorage, Alaska. And they were overwintering as adults, so that pretty well narrowed down the genus in my worldview. And she sent us beautiful pink lacewings. And when they came out of diapause, they have a song that is identical to Chrysoperla agilis, and they will hybridize, they will breed with agilis. Best guess at this point is that the Anchorage Airport, which is the third busiest cargo airport in the world, probably brought in some agilis, but we're hoping to get back and work on that. Unfortunately, my student, well, unfortunately from our perspective, she got a job in Wisconsin and is now several thousand miles closer to her husband, but several thousand miles farther from the lacewings we want. So we had, I think at this point, most of the species worked out. Charlie did some molecular work. Very nice separation between the North American and European faunae, but we had polycotomies within each continent, and Charlie described it as, it looks like they speciated about 12 years ago. It was not informative. So in wrap up here, what we want to do next is we want to start to look at the Asian fauna. We have at least six song species from Asia, but for all kinds of obvious reasons, progress is slow. These are two of the big ones. But we keep dabbling along, and we get lucky occasionally and get another sample. So in summary, we seem to have at this point 18 known cryptic species in the Chrysoperla carnea complex. Seven in North America. I previously showed you a list of only four. There are a couple of additional things that may be distinct units within what's currently called Downsi. The five from Europe and at least six from Asia. Of these, 11 are currently well-defined, seven very poorly defined with undescribed species in the US and Asia, and probably still additional taxa to be discovered in Asia. Here is a list of the species as we recognize them based on song with at least continental association. Here you can see the three remaining mysteries, potential mysteries within Downsi. Agilis just added probably as a contaminant. The five now reasonably well-established European species. Generator from the Middle East was again determined to be conspecific with Zastrowe from Southern Africa, the first trans-equatorial distribution. And very, very recently, Charlie got some specimens of Salemi from India, and it looks like Zastrowe and Salemi will be synonymized. But that leaves us two species within what is currently recognized as Nipponensis, plus a couple of Charlie's names, Echo and Blacksmith, for unnamed song species, and again, the probability of more to come there. And with that, I would like to thank you for the opportunity, and thank Katie and Maurice for everything they've done for me and so many others. And if there are any questions, I'd be delighted to try to answer them. Yes?
That's sort of a practical question. Since they need to duet, does it matter when you rear these things, what kind of container? Can you use the last containers, or do you have to have a substrate?
I have never reared them in a container that would preclude vibration, so I really can't say that. I usually rear them in unwaxed Dixie cups with a plastic lid that is a very suitable substrate for the vibration. I would assume that if you did rear them on a where there was no substrate for courtship, it might have a disruptive effect, but I've never tested that because I've always been working to achieve successful reproduction. Anybody else? Well, thank you very much.